Good morning. I'm Andrew McInerney, so I'm chairing today. The reminder that I've been asked to give you all, keep an eye on the feedback, so get them coming through so that we can collect them quite quickly. We've got two schemes presenting today. Firstly, we'll have the WA scheme, and then we'll have South Australia. Michelle and Leona will be doing the WA presentation, and Michael Francis will do the SA. So we'll get started. Michelle Reynolds is the CEO of WorkCover WA, and she's been doing that role since 2008. I'm going to do the very abridged version of the bio here so that we can try and create as much room as possible. And Leona Gladsby has managed the business intelligence delivery at WorkCover WA since 2010. So she's responsible for data collection, analysis and reporting, and works closely with the actuary to ensure the high-quality advice gets through to the board and senior management. So without further ado, I will pass over to Michelle, and she'll get started.
Good morning, everyone. I hope you're all feeling well after last night. I know some are a little bit worse for wear, but let's begin, shall we, by talking about the West Australian Workers' Compensation Scheme. So, a lot has happened at WorkCover over the last several years. This is, I think, my third actuaries conference, and they just get better and better. But from a scheme perspective, I missed the last one. So over the last 4 years, it's been an interesting time. So I'll reflect back a little bit, if you don't mind, and I will be discussing the points that are raised on this overhead. So this is WorkCover, the organisation. We're a statutory authority of 140 people. Primarily, we are a regulator with conciliation and arbitration services and also policy and legislation responsibilities. So we have the role of leading a contemporary, healthy and integrated workers' compensation scheme that is fair and accessible, but also cost-effective for all of the participants. And we do this, and our role in regulation and administration, under the umbrella of the Workers' Compensation and Injury Management Act 1981. So primarily, we have responsibility to set statutory compensation entitlements. We promote injury management and vocational rehabilitation of injured workers for the successful return to work. We regulate and monitor the performance of our service providers, and these are insurers, self-insurers, approved vocational rehab providers and registered agents. We also provide a conciliation and arbitration service to resolve disputes. We register agreements where parties seek to settle a claim for compensation or to determine a worker's level of permanent impairment for civil action. And we also have a role in common law, which is a distinct feature of our scheme with a criteria to access the court system. So if you are looking at undertaking or pursuing a common law damages claim against your employer, you have to have a whole person impairment of at least 15%. There are limits on damages depending on the degree of impairment. So we are a privately underwritten scheme, and we are funded via a levy on insurers who are approved by us to underwrite workers' compensation in Western Australia. And this also extends to self-insurers. The scheme is a no-fault scheme. Our market structure is dominated by four big insurers, those being QBE, GIO, CGU and Allianz, and they, each of them, have between 19 and 22% of premium market share. So we keep a very close eye on those large insurers because what happens to them affects the overall health of our scheme. We also have 27 self-insurers, and some of them are mentioned here, who operate in our scheme, and they account for about 12% of our claims activity. So our scheme operates at a cost of about $1 billion, and 67% of that money is paid in direct compensation to workers through weekly benefits or lump sum payments, and the rest are through service costs. I can't go very far without talking about our legislation. And although the scheme has been very stable and performing well, the legislation that underpins it is starting to show its age. So it has been amended piecemeal over many years and is now a very complex and highly prescriptive statute, which is very difficult to understand and apply. So in 2009, we commenced a process, a multi-stage process, with the aim of creating a flexible and responsive piece of legislation. Excuse me. With the exception of dispute resolution, the review did not involve any fundamental changes to the design of our scheme. The review was highly consultative, and in 2011, we implemented the first range of all of those changes. Excuse me again. The introduction of a new dispute resolution model, we removed the age-based limits on entitlement, and we also extended a safety net arrangement for injured workers of uninsured employers. So those changes have been successfully bedded down. Interestingly, the removal of age limits has had no material impact on our scheme, although it is very early days, so we'll see what happens. A further outcome of the first stage was that government agreed to a rewrite of our Act and regulations. So since 2012, we've been working with our stakeholders to design this new statute. And the overriding goal of that process is to develop an act that has plain language and contemporary drafting. It also has a clear logical structure, and we will use our regulations to enable some flexibility. So all very positive from that perspective. And in late 2014, the government agreed to the recommendations and drafting commenced. It's important to note that the new bill is not going or isn't being badged as a reform. The basic elements of our scheme and certainly the benefit structure will remain unchanged. There are, however, a few changes which are worth noting. We have for some time had some problems with the definition of worker, so we're looking to provide some clarity around that. And I will share, we've had one of our early Uber cases coming up, so we'll work out whether an Uber driver is a worker or not shortly. There has been no changes to core compensation entitlements, although we will be clarifying the weekly payment calculation methods. The existing 15% step down at 13 weeks will continue, but there is a safety net award for workers who are on awards. And also, our death benefits are exceedingly low, and so there has been agreement that we will increase those to approximately 550,000. So that's a good change. And access to settlements is, as I said earlier, a distinct feature of our scheme. And what we're looking to do is really improve and clarify that settlement pathway and to put some boundaries around their use. So still to continue, but with some approved certainty. All of these changes are actually on our website, so please feel free if you'd like a little bit more detail. I was told, because this is an actuaries conference, I have to talk about statistics, so bear with me. And I'm now going to briefly touch on some of the recent performances of our scheme. And as I think I've already alluded to, our scheme is performing very well. We have long-term stability that characterises our scheme. And as you can see with our premium rate, our current average rate at 1.483 is particularly low. I think it's the second lowest after Comcare. There has been significant reduction in claim numbers in the last 3 years. They fell during the GFC but increased ever so slightly and then have fallen away again. So claims reported in 14-15 are the lowest annual number of claims in the history of our scheme. Most of the reduction in claims seem to be at the low end of claims with no lost time or short duration. Claim payments have not fallen in line with the reduction of claim numbers. In fact, claim payments have increased by 15% over the last 4 years. These figures are adjusted for inflation to allow for comparison over time. The increased claim numbers reflect really, from our perspective, the longer claim durations, and currently an average claim is open anywhere between 7 and 8 months. We've seen an increase in the payments over the last few years, mainly due to increases in wages and also long duration claims. But there is some indications that it is starting to level out. So most workers don't need much time off work. However, of the 17,334 claims with lost time off work, 32% of these claims had 60 or more days off. So these claims are classed as serious injuries. So over 5,000 workers have serious injuries every year. Lump sum settlements are a significant aspect of our scheme, and we have two main settlement pathways, statutory redemptions and common law entitlements. The level of settlements by statutory redemptions has remained steady at 10% of finalised claims. Common law settlements rely on sections of our legislation to be applied before you can reach agreement. In recent years, we've seen an increase in the use of this pathway. Although most claims do not actually end up ever in the courts, the election to pursue common law damages starts that settlement discussion. Dispute resolution was introduced in, our new model was introduced in 2011, and I'm very pleased to say that our numbers, our timeliness, our accessibility and our costs are very much better than they were. So the proportion of all disputes are resolved within 6 months at about 88.8%, and this is as was predicted. So our results are also, if I can use the comparative performance monitoring report by Safe Work Australia, the national average is 63.9. So while we have a low rate of disputation at 3.1%, in recent times we're seeing this number increasing. So looking ahead, the ever-changing landscape of workers' compensation. We are very mindful that the nature of work continues to evolve and change. There is more contracting, technological advances and the ageing workforce. We are watching the progress of our self-insurance arrangement, particularly under ComCare, and looking at the potential impacts on our scheme. The longer claim durations and higher costs need a constant focus for our organisation. So part of monitoring our scheme and sharing that information with our participants is part of Leona Gladsby's role. And today we thought we'd take a few moments of your time to showcase something that we think is quite exceptional. It's a monitoring framework that is provided to our board that really gives them a very high level of certainty that the wellness and health of our scheme is going ahead. And so, Leona, we thought today would share with you that framework of how we monitor our scheme. And if I could introduce Leona Gladsby up to the lectern.
Thank you, Michelle. And you can see they're my team, and I couldn't do what I do without them. So they deserve some of the limelight as well. So I think we all agree that a best practice scheme will be based on evidence-based decision making. But to obtain and monitor that evidence obviously requires collecting a considerable amount of data. Our statistical system has clear data requirements, and it relies on the timely contribution of data by the insurers that Michelle showed you on the slide there before. We've got quite a number of them. We've got a central business intelligence system, and that draws on detailed data from a number of sources. That system's been developed over the past few years. It wasn't something that we envisaged and just had a project and bang, there it was. We've built it up over a number of years, and that continues to evolve as we go forward. The data that feeds into that system includes the claims data and policy data that's coming to us from those insurers and the exempt employers, That's collected in accordance with the National Insurer Data Specification. So in WA, we implemented that in 2013-14, and by now all the privately underwritten jurisdictions are using that specification. So that just really aims to give consistency, especially for insurers that are doing business across more than one state. And internally, we also collect dispute, settlement and enforcement data. So we regularly extract that data from the various databases. We put it into our data warehouse. And through that, we aspire to have a single source of truth for the scheduled reports that we do and also to respond to any ad hoc queries. So again, I think we'd all agree that consistent and reliable data analysis is really important for identifying and responding to emerging issues and emerging pressure points. So we have a wide range of indicators from those internal and external sources to identify those points. And I'm going to show you our primary tool for scheme performance monitoring. We call that the Scheme Viability Report. And the report is structured around four scheme viability principles, and those would probably apply to most injury schemes. The first principle is that it's funded, that provisions are made for the claim liabilities. Second one is that it's equitable, that the premium rates that we set and the fees that are charged by service providers are equitable. Third principle is that it's regulated, so scheme participants act in accordance with the legislation. And then, obviously, the last component is that it's timely and fair. So injury management, financial compensation are timely and fair for the people that need it. On the right there, so that's our scheme viability framework. We've got our four principles. Below each one of those are a number of objectives. Those objectives are actually linked up to risks in our risk register, and there's also supporting information that goes with each principle and objective. So this is actually a look inside one of our internal reports, the Scheme Viability Report. So as Michelle said, this is the main report that we use for reporting to the board. And although we talk a lot about scheme monitoring and so forth, you perhaps don't always get a chance to see right down at this level of detail. So this part of report shows one of the objectives under the principle injury management and financial compensation are timely and fair. And the objective links back to the death benefits. So dependents of fatally injured workers receive fair compensation. So the main components are highlighted. The principles up there at the top of the page. We've got the objective, we've got the risk, and then we've got the supporting information. We've also got the source. So the supporting information comes from comparisons with death benefits in other jurisdictions, and that comes from the comparative performance monitoring report. So that's what we're using as our guide there. And as we've got a low death benefit in comparison with the other jurisdictions, that's flagged with a little watch symbol, a little pair of glasses there. At the front of the report, we have a summary of those issues. So all the ones throughout the report that are flagged with the little watch symbol end up summarised here. So we've got more than two. That's this is just a little excerpt. Some get removed as issues are addressed, and so then they move off the list, and then other times we'll see new issues added. So you can see the latest update for the death benefits issue. We did an extensive review of that issue in conjunction with other jurisdictions, but of course that requires legislative change to make amendments, and so until then that's going to stay on the list. So it clearly shows where the scheme's positioned relative to the historical trends and comparisons with performance in other jurisdictions. And the board do rely on that report very much as a checklist for scheme health. So overall, our scheme's in pretty good shape. However, there are a number of issues that we do need to be mindful of going forward. Now, I do have at the front here, there are a number of statistical brochures. This is the latest stats from the WA scheme, so at the end of the session, please come up and help yourself to one of those brochures. If you'd like any more information about WorkCover WA, there's some contact details up on the screen there. I think we're going to hold questions until after the South Australian presentation, so I'll hand you over to that now.
Could you join me in thanking the owner and the
Sorry, I'll just get this one up. We now have Michael Francis from Return to Work SA. Michael is the General Manager of Regulation. He's stepping in at pretty short notice because Peter Worthington Eyre, who was going to be here, is just become a father for the second time. So Michael is here under limited preparation, but I'm sure he will do a great job. I'll hand over to you, Michael.
Thanks for the excuses, Andrew. No excuses, really. If I don't know this stuff, I shouldn't be in my job. So unlike what Michelle and Leona have been able to talk to you about as having fundamentally been a stably performed scheme over the last, it appears, at least 7 or 8 years in Western Australia, South Australia hasn't been a stably well-performed scheme in that sense. So I'm pleased to be able to stand up here and report, probably unlike at the last one of these actuarial conferences, which is a couple of years ago now, that the trajectory's changed in a positive direction for us, and that there are a number of things that have happened to really contribute toward what's been a wholesale turnaround in terms of at least that trajectory, fully acknowledging that there's a long way for us to go in order to achieve what we're really setting out to try and achieve in that sense. So to begin with, and I might just use this. No, it doesn't want to work. Okay, got there. I'm going to throw the numbers up straight away. Okay. And just talk in and around those, because what we've got here is a picture of the scheme as it is at present, I suppose, to give you a bit of an indication of just the size of our scheme and the experience that we have at the moment. But what I want to do is, whilst keeping this slide up, is give you a bit of an understanding of just how we've come to that position, because, for example, if you look at the top left of that slide over here, where it's talking about our funding position being at 114%, I know that just over 2.5 years or so ago, we were sitting closer to 60%, or just under 60% in that sense. So there's a number of things that have changed to help us get there. So I was fortunate to be part of a change in Return to Work SA that was led by Greg McCarthy, and a number of you would have heard Greg speak at the opening plenary yesterday in the morning. And really, to give you a bit more of a sense of how it is that we came to start making some of these changes, I'd like to give you a sense of some of the principles that we applied, both to, I suppose, hold us true to try and achieve some of those targeted outcomes that Greg referred to, but also in terms of just understanding the fundamentals of perhaps where things had gone wrong for the South Australian scheme over many years that had led to it being so significantly underfunded and the most expensive scheme in the country, with incredibly poor return to work rates. Not a good report card that we had historically, but with that comes opportunity, I suppose. But the first part of that journey was really recognising our purpose and our functions, and going from being what I would describe as a very risk-adverse, compliance-orientated regulator, and pretty much that alone, that saw regulation as the source of improvement in our scheme, to one where we recognise some distinct functions of being an insurer and a regulator, and starting to try and appreciate the fundamental imperatives toward achieving success within both of those roles separately. Okay, so they might sound like really obvious things, but when you walk into an organisation and a jurisdiction where you've got a lot of really well-meaning, intelligent people working really hard and not getting anywhere, some of those fundamental realisations just need to come to the fore, I suppose, about what it is that we're actually trying to achieve. So in that sense, we spoke about the purpose in terms of both the social charter that we have in terms of achieving better outcomes for those people who are injured within our scheme, but also getting this scheme into a financially viable state. So when you go from that fundamental understanding of who you are and what you're there to achieve, then getting really clear about who your stakeholders are. There are a number of conversations that we had around ensuring that we were really clear, and I've heard this at a number of different session so far that our stakeholders are the workers who pay, I should say the workers who are injured and the employers who pay premiums. Everybody else is a service provider. We had a jurisdiction that was characterised by what I'd describe as a lot of permission seeking from vested interest groups as well as the stakeholders themselves in terms of, and in many ways I think that that was a, whilst as an outsider coming in was a clearly a strategy that wasn't working, it was a way in which you could absolve yourself of responsibility almost by suggesting that somehow or another if you were just applying the principles or applying the rules of the game that you'd somehow or another manage to get consensus from a whole range of different people in and around the scheme to perform, that somehow or another it absolved you of that responsibility. So a fundamental starting point of our journey was acknowledging that this thing was broken and that we were at the centre of it and we had to take responsibility for trying to shift the trajectory of it, because again there was a lot of this going on, and it was claims agents, it was, you know, rehab providers, it was doctors who wouldn't certify people for capacity, all stories that people in this room have heard for a long time. So beyond the recognition of it being broken in that sense, we then started to apply some specific strategies. And without going over too much of the history, I do want to give you a bit of an understanding of both the strategies and some of the principles that guided some of those to help us get to this particular position. And then what I want to focus, what bit of time I have left on, is in and around where I see the challenges now in terms of maintaining the momentum that's been gained over the last couple of years. So the first one of these was that I think beyond, you could chunk it into the front end and the back end strategies, I suppose. So at the front end, very clearly we needed to get into a more expeditious mode in terms of determination of claims as they came through the door and being really active in terms of the decision-making process. We've become very passive in that sense. We had, for example, in our psychological injury claims space, fallen into a pattern of managing those claims as they came in the door by putting people immediately onto a thing called provisional liability, leaving them there for 3 months, then putting in place a factual investigation process where essentially it took us 3 months to gather the relevant information before any active decision-making actually occurred. So it was little wonder, for example, that in that space we had very high levels of acceptance, because we had people who'd become... I'll use the word that they're addicted, but they had become got onto a path of benefit dependency in a very short period of time in that space. And it's much more difficult to, for example, take something away than it is to make a decision in the first place. That, again, it sounds like stating the obvious, but again, like many schemes, in looking at where some of the things that were broken were going awry, we had 4% of the claims coming through the door being psychological injury claims, closer to 20% of the cost, and going in the wrong direction. So there were some simple things we could do in that space in terms of speeding up the time it took us to get the relevant information. We had what I would broadly describe as reasonable management action provisions within our legislation, which immediately excluded a number of those applications for compensation in and around psychological injury claims that we were paying little or no attention to in the first instance, which would have immediately put out some of those particular claims that we were dealing with. And that's why we had 80 and 90% acceptance rates in and around psychological injury claims, where other jurisdictions with like definitions of what's compensable sitting in around the 50 or 60% in that space. So there were some straightforward things just in terms of timeliness and getting active that we could do. Getting clear about the relationships that we had with the respective service providers in the scheme. I spoke about acknowledging who the stakeholders were, but with those other service providers, again, applying a mindset that was very clear about when people came to us and would use words like, we want to partner with you or be in partnership with you in terms of how we go about doing what we're doing, that unless there is... they have the same skin in the game that we do, we're not working in partnership. We absolutely need to work together, but we can't try and pretend that somehow or another, whilst we have some similar interest in terms of how we're going to achieve a better outcome for those stakeholders in this scheme, that we're not coming from exactly the same position in that sense. So we need to be really clear about that. So our claims agents have been instrumental in this space. So in terms of what we had to take responsibility for, we had... contractual arrangements with our claims agents with north of 200 KPIs in the space. So I think it was well north of that, actually. So, and making sure that we understood that if we wanted our claims agents to be focused on the outcomes that we could achieve for people, if we were giving them 200 plus what I would describe as more process orientated KPIs to be attending to, is it any wonder that we became very administratively focused and caught in a mire of trying to comply with those, comply with KPIs rather than meet performance objectives that we were trying to achieve for our scheme. So we totally reviewed the KPI framework within the contracts that we had and the remuneration structures that worked in and around those. At the other end of, I suppose, the burning platform that we had, where we were very much hemorrhaging financially, remember that the break-even premium for our scheme, well, you probably wouldn't remember if you don't work in South Australia, was around 3.34% at the time. This is not, was not a cheap scheme to run. It was incredibly expensive. And a large part of those expenses, it'll be little surprise to you, were in the tail. We had work capacity review provisions that were introduced into the legislation in 2008 that, for all intent and purpose, weren't being applied. We had decisions being made on time at around 10 or 12% of the time when those particular matters came to a point where those decisions needed to be made, which was at about the 2.5 year point. So setting strategies in place to make sure that we weren't just making the decisions on time, but our claims agents were equipped to go through a process with those people to get them ready for when a particular decision needed to be made, to a point where what we can say is, prior to our recent legislative changes and for at least the last 18 months or so, we were at a position where we were getting closer to 90% plus of those decisions being made on time. These are fundamental things, but again, if we're just not actually applying the law and the tools that we've been given, it's little wonder that we had difficulty in that space. So, and I won't pretend to understand necessarily the reasons why, but I can only postulate that part of that was to do with people's views one way or the other about the relative fairness of certain provisions that were introduced. And it was our position to make sure that we understood not just one side of that equation, but also one of the other objects of our Act beyond providing benefits to workers was also to make sure that it was affordable for employers. Quite apart from the adverse effects of people being long-term benefit dependent that were created by this, I would argue that the view that somehow or another ignoring the exercising of those provisions was actually detrimental to the health of workers who are actually remaining on our scheme for a long period of time. So without labouring that, so that we can get further into where we're at now, I suppose, some of the other things that worked particularly well for us in terms of trying to shift the paradigm that we had within our own business towards one of providing service and being really clear about trying to manage the scheme for performance was acknowledging that we needed to be have a really strong consciousness both as a regulator and insurer of where our risks lay. So that, again, where our strategies were applied and where we followed through in and around the regulation-orientated aspects of our responsibilities, it was where there were material risks in our scheme. So, again, we had early return to work consultants that became the forerunner to the mobile case managers that I'll speak about in a moment, whereby we provided some very specific assistance to small business. So small businesses who were defined as premium payers of $20,000 or less, where there was an injury that was indicative of having somebody off work for more than 10 days or more, had specifically qualified people to go out and provide a service to that particular employer and injured worker in terms of trying to assist them to get back on track and get back to work. Through that type of service, we had, in a relatively short period of time, were able to demonstrate about a 20% reduction in the actual development costs associated with the income support in that space about 12 months after we started applying those sorts of strategies. So I'll speak about mobile case management more in a moment and we talk about where we're at now. The other side of things that we did, just as an example, I don't pretend to be able to go through all of the strategies we applied at the moment, was introduce a range of advisory services. It, again, started out with a very risk-orientated approach whereby we tried to understand the profile of the employers who were insured within our scheme and those who were both costing us money but also for them, it was costing them money, and clearly the human cost within their businesses was high in terms of what was happening in terms of their claims experiences. So rather than seeing it as purely a regulatory responsibility and almost using the premium as a pure penalty, making sure that we're out there and providing what we would describe as a very competitive consulting or consultancy offering to those particular businesses, even though it was coming from a regulator. Now, that's a very difficult message to sell early on, and it takes time to get trust and credibility in that space. But what I can say is that of the 400 or so employers that we dealt with in that space, since that time, we got to a point whereby the sorts of, again, income support cost reductions in that group were in the order of about 30%. So is that the... OK? Yep, so... That just gives you a bit of a sense of where we started, so, and how we got things changed. So now we return to WorkSA. We're not WorkCover South Australia anymore, and we've got a new legislative regime in place. So, and as the slide suggests, it's not just a name change, it's a game change, in the sense that very much what we've tried to do with this new brand, if you like, is make sure that we live and breathe the service expectations that our stakeholders should legitimately have of us in this state. And when I say that, we've got a system now where we effectively have two tranches of benefit that are available to people who are hurt in the workplace. We have one whereby there are those who are 30% or more whole person impaired under AMA guides, who receive lifetime care and support and access to income support through to retirement age. We have those who are not in those categories who have up to 2 years of income support and a further 12 months of medical benefits able to be paid for. There are some exceptions in there in and around people who require further surgery, etc., beyond those years. But fundamentally, it's been incredibly important to us that we take our responsibility really seriously, as the name suggests, as being Return to Work SA. Our new legislation doesn't use the words compensation very often at all, if at all. It doesn't use the words rehabilitation very often at all. We talk about return to work services again because of the desire to seek and maintain absolute clarity about what our charter is and what it is that we're actually trying to achieve in that space. So in terms of making sure that we're really focused with the hard boundaries that we have on being able to provide what I would describe as first-rate service to those people who are hurt, we've got fundamental opportunities to go beyond some of the traditional compensation schemes efforts in the retraining space toward giving people forklift tickets and security guard licences and those types of what I would describe as almost tokenistic types of retraining that we've provided in the past, to making sure that we channel some of our renewed, I would describe as capacity, into making sure that we're actually meeting the service expectations which are specified within our legislative regime. So to make sure that you just get a bit of a sense of, again, some of the fundamental strategies, and I'm just going to list these off without going into any great detail, and feel free to come and interrogate me in and around those after this session, but things like the mobile case management service are really some of the things which a lot of people have an interest in. We have in excess of 100 people across both of our claims agents whose primary role it is, as Greg McCarthy suggested, to go out to workplaces and to injured people and ask how they can help those people. Not to necessarily prescribe what could or should happen in those instances, but to help them to understand what their options are and try and help the respective parties in that space to actually get to a very constructive engagement whereby they understand what's best for them. It's a situation where we're clearly not providing that service to all, but again, only to those where it looks as though they're likely to be off work for 10 days or more. The others that we have in the space are clearly we have... In the service provider space, we've got a completely refreshed medical engagement strategy whereby we're seeking to provide far greater support to general practitioners within the scheme so that they can interact with us in a meaningful way. We completely reformed return to work services toward a very outcome-orientated approach, and again, to the tune of, for example, in the job placement service space, whereby we've got approximately 130% better results in that space in terms of outcomes at 6 months. So what I do want to do is just quickly show you some of the numbers so you get a bit of a sense of what the turnarounds look like. if not for the scheme reform, that probably would have sat, and Andrew might correct me here, at somewhere around, I would say, the 75-ish percent mark, or a little better than that perhaps, but moving in the right direction since some of these reforms have been in place. In terms of our net asset position, we're actually in the black again for the first time in a very long time, which is, again, a more healthy space to be. But if you look at the media down here, there are a number of people looking to redress that being in the black situation at the moment. So in terms of actuarial releases along the way, again, this is prior to the scheme reforms, but it certainly has been... I think Len was asked a question yesterday about how do you actually understand some of these cultural changes that you're trying to drive within your scheme and making a difference, and you clearly have to look at some of the numbers at the end of it to work out whether or not you're meeting the affordable scheme and health benefits of work matters. So I'm not going to go through these. These are the reductions in the number of people going through the respective milestones. That's not a pure return to work rate, but I can say that, for example, in at least up to the 26-week mark, you're looking at about 80% of those being actual return to works in terms of reductions of people going through those milestones, and it's evidence of the more active approach being taken up front. The average premium rate, we've finally got a reduction in that space, and hopefully we can look forward to some more reductions, so with a significant decrease in the number of people income-dependent over time. So with that, I'm going to stop, and hopefully you get at least a couple of chances to ask some questions. So,
well, I think we're actually out of time, unless anyone has something that's quite a specific yes-no question that we could take very quickly, but anything that's commentary or long-winded, that's all right.
Hi, this is Amy from Suncorp. Leona mentioned that one of the monitoring things that WA scheme does is actually compared to other jurisdictions. So I'm just so that gave me the impression that WA scheme want to compare and make sure that they're not too different to the other schemes. So just wondering, is there any like discussions between different schemes to compare like consistencies of benefit structures to ensure more of consistency between the different benefit structures?
Is there a quick answer? Perhaps it's a question for outside, I think, for that one.
Yes.
Yeah. If you could join me in thanking Michael and also Michelle and the owner. So,